should any of us be looking at product and design and UIs without looking at the bigger implications? Should I be looking at a piece of hardware that Facebook just put out and not think about the fact and not dig into the fact that it was put out by Facebook, which is currently under a lot of scrutiny for the company's practices? So I think the latter is actually the way in which that we, like, it's our responsibility as technology reporters to look at this. We can't just blindly look at a product anymore and say, here's this product, and it's like, you know, it's a unibody machined aluminum thing. Like, you have to actually look at what's inside the box and what that box is connecting to.
Hey everyone, welcome back to episode 7 of the Austin Meyer podcast, where I interview the world's best storytellers in all sorts of genres about how they craft the stories they tell. If you are new here, it's great to meet you. I'm Austin Meyer, and I'm a documentary filmmaker and National Geographic explorer on a journey to continually get better at telling stories. And whether you want to tell better stories yourself or are just interested in going behind the scenes to see how the narratives shaping our world are made, you're in the right place. This week on the show, I'm so excited to welcome Lauren Good. Lauren is an Emmy Award-winning journalist and senior writer at Wired covering consumer technology. Before arriving at Wired, Lauren was the senior technology editor at The Verge, managing editor of reviews and consumer tech coverage at Recode, and a video producer at The Wall Street Journal. Lauren and I met while we were at Stanford, where we overlapped in the journalism graduate program, and I've always been so impressed with how masterful she is at telling stories in all sorts of mediums. She is a full-time writer, but also hosts podcasts and produces videos, all of which amount to what I think is some of the best reporting on consumer tech out there today. In this conversation, we touch on Lauren's career path and the lessons that she learned along the way, and then we move into the ethical responsibilities of technology reporting and how she is designing stories for the various platforms she works on. So let's get into it. I hope you enjoy my conversation with Lauren Good. Cool. Should we get started?
Let's do it.
Let's do it. All right, Lauren Good, thank you so much for joining episode. I think this is going to be episode 7 of the Austin Meyer podcast.
Lucky number 7.
Lucky
Thanks
number
for having
7.
Me, Austin.
Yeah,
it's,
yeah.
It's really good to connect with you again.
Yeah, you too. All right, so listeners, Lauren and I went to Stanford at the same time. She was in the graduate program of journalism when I was an undergrad, and we overlapped in some classes. And I actually, Lauren, don't know, like, where were you in your journalist career when you arrived at Stanford? So maybe you can give a little bit of background about where you're from and how did you arrive into this graduate program where I met you?
Sure, absolutely. So my story is a little bit unusual, just in the sense that I didn't decide to go into a graduate program until after I had been working for several years. Sometimes that happens with certain programs, but I think in the case of journalism, a lot of times people tend to go to J school when they're maybe younger and still trying to figure out what they want to do or what direction they want to take their storytelling in. And I had been working in newsrooms for a little while, and I just had seen so many changes happening in journalism and in newsrooms in particular, and constantly having to adapt to new, you know, adapt to new technologies and just so many changes going on. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was just an alignment of things that happened where I felt like I was ready to leave New York after being there for a very long time. I was looking into graduate programs. I happened to get into Stanford. It seemed like Stanford was starting to focus more on things like data journalism and multimedia. And I felt like, and it was also a one-year program. So yeah. I wasn't going to be out of the workforce for too long. So I ended up going. Well, and whether or not, yeah, I would recommend people go to J school if they want to be a journalist is a whole other, we could probably have like a whole other podcast about
yeah,
that.
Yeah, I agree.
But I went to Stanford.
What were some of those early journalism jobs that you had? Were those related to tech or what were you doing?
I have a very circuitous path to what I do now. I started as a PA, started in television, mm-hmm. Television news, and I was a production assistant for a few years. And that was just, it was very accidental, to be honest. I knew when I was an undergrad that I wanted to work in the media, and I knew I wanted to write and tell stories, and I hadn't really settled on the format. And I happened to know people in production.
Okay.
So, that's just, and I wanted to move to New York and I wanted to start working. So that's how I ended up as a PA. And from there, you know, I kind of had this path where I was working in sports news. I left sports news. I went to A&E TV Networks. I was an associate producer and a writer at A&E TV for about a year and a half. Mm-hmm. It was like a contract job. What's funny about that is I was working on this division of the biography series that was called, like, I wish I could remember now. Now I feel old, but it was something like Redesign or Revamp or something like that. And what we would do is we would go through the monthly programming schedule and find all of the biographies, the hour-long biographies that were slated to run during primetime.
Okay.
And we would go through those people's lives. I mean, this could be anybody. This could be like the biography of Bill Gates or Drew Barrymore or the Google guys or, you know, Al Gore, fill in the blanks. And we would see it, like, if anything significant had happened in their lives, which of course these are very high profile people in a lot of cases. So of course a lot had happened since we had first commissioned the documentary. And then we would have to go in and update them in order to make them current for primetime. And so, like, I was writing updates to people's biographies for like a year and a half.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And then I'm rambling. Then I ended up at the Wall Street Journal working as video producer.
Okay.
And from there, that was when my pivot to full-time writing really happened.
Okay. So when we were emailing before we got on the podcast, you mentioned that your experience with web video at the Wall Street Journal was an interesting experience for you in terms of, were you starting web video at the Wall Street Journal, or what, had it kind of already been a thing when you got there?
It had already been a thing,
okay.
But it was still fairly early in the days of newspapers having web video. And it was still one of these things that I think in newsrooms was met with a lot of suspicion. Mm-hmm. Because what was happening was you were working with these really talented and well-established print reporters, people who were used to meeting a deadline every day, used to their method of sourcing and writing stories to a certain standard, a very high standard. And you were asking them to disrupt their day to do web video. And of course, this is where a lot of the attention was starting to go and where a lot of the advertising dollars were starting to go. So there were big incentives for newsrooms to get into web video, but it was still just like, why are you interrupting my day and asking me to stand in the middle of the newsroom and talk to a camera? So so purely from that perspective, like, it was kind of a fun challenge being a web video producer in such an established newsroom. Mm. But what we started to do, and what a lot of the newspapers around, this is between 2008 and 2011 or so. So you're talking about like the peak of the financial crisis. And you're also talking about like Obama was elected. I mean, there was a lot going on in the news in that time period and a lot to cover. This was also around the time that newspapers like the New York Times and the Huffington Post were also investing heavily in web video. And in particular, what we were doing at the Wall Street Journal was we were launching live streaming web video.
Oh, interesting. What platform were you using for that at the time?
I'm honestly trying to remember. I mean, I remember for our, it wasn't a tech platform, and it wasn't like Facebook or Periscope or anything like that.
Yeah.
We were using, for our published videos, or on-demand videos, we were using Brightcove, I believe. And it might have been some version of the same system that was publishing things live. But even just investing in kind of the infrastructure and the gear and everything to make live streaming happen then, about a decade ago, was so much different from today, where you just open your phone app and you start live streaming a video. So all these things sort of had to come together in a way that now we just assume is the case. But what we found largely was, like, we created this programming schedule where we would have, if you wanted to watch the market show, which I helped produce, you know, you'd have to go to the website at 8:30 in the morning and watch the market show. And if you wanted to watch the tech show, which I ended up producing and co-hosting, you'd have to go to the website at 1:00. And if you want, you know, and so we had like five or six shows a day. And what we found after 2 or 3 years of doing this was that people still just wanted to watch the on-demand clips. Like, people weren't appointment watching on WSJ.com.
They weren't tuning in live.
Right. And if you think about it, like, I call it sort of like the Netflixification of our video watching society had already happened. People were already getting used to, like, I'm going to go to YouTube or I'm going to go to Netflix and I'm going to watch this thing when I feel like watching it. I'm going to do it when it works for me. I'm going to do it on my mobile phone. I'm not going to do it when somebody tells me to go to website and watch, unless it's like a really big must-see live event.
Right.
And so we learned that after a while that like you can't just take the cable news sort of model of like, we're going to sit here at a desk and talk to you and you're going to tune in because this time is the time you need to tune in. That wasn't working. We had to really rethink how we were doing web video. And I think that's something that a lot of news properties have had to deal with over the past decade and have like finally come around to.
So yeah, and let's continue on that path. So we'll get back to how you arrived where you are today. But in your career doing web video now, you've done it all over the place. Especially, I know you were doing a lot of video when you were at The Verge. What are some ways that you found web video really works? Or how you craft those videos, not just like a cable news schedule translated to the web?
Yeah, that's a really good question. One of the things I would say that web video allows you to do a little bit more than very produced, highly produced TV is that you can be a little bit more raw in a web video. You can be a little more off the cuff. You can mess up and correct yourself. Not mess up and like make a serious, you know, mistake or allegation. That's not true. But I mean, just like kind of stumble your words a little bit. You can pull back the curtain a little bit in terms of how you arrived at a conclusion or how you made the video itself. I've also found that length is, I mean, now we're seeing YouTube is actually encouraging people to make videos that are 20 minutes or longer, of course, because it's part of an advertising play to insert mid-rolls and whatnot. But like you can go really long on a YouTube video. And if you have a captive audience, they will watch it as opposed to this sort of slickly produced television news package, which is, you know, you get it out in 2.5 to 3 minutes and then you're done. So there's that. And then I think like the bigger thing is that with web video, you do have a little bit more of a feedback loop. Like if you're making TV, I mean, you get data, you have ratings, you know who's watching to a point. But on web video, like even the comments, as toxic and as crazy as some of them can be, you do get a sense of how people are feeling, what they're responding to and reacting to, what's working with the audience, what's not. And all of those things create this loop between who's producing the video, who's making the video, and who's watching it in a way that wasn't really previously available. So all of this from a production perspective, I think, plays into like making a video that feels like it's actually made for the web and not just taking something that was an old model of TV video and chopping it up and throwing it up on the web.
Do you read the comments that people post on your articles and your videos and stuff like that?
Sometimes. Okay. Depends on how, like, I don't know if it's a day of fortitude or not. yeah, like they are really helpful. I mean, I'd say the number one comment that I get to this day is still, "Where's your twin?" Which is just, you have to like, it's a nerd thing. If you watched my Verge videos,
I
don't have a twin, but we made a twin and using like a not very special effect. And for whatever reason, it really resonated with people of like two of me really arguing with each other. And so to this day, if I do just a video with myself, which is what I normally do, they're like, it's like the number one comment is just, "Where's your twin?" So,
for the listeners, that's a video series Lauren did with Verses or with Verge called Verses, where she and her twin would have two different devices and they would be talking about the why their device is great, essentially, right?
right. And there was one character that's very much like the Apple lover, the quintessential like Apple sort of sheep who's like, I love anything Apple. And then there's the more sarcastic person who believes in like open source and like you don't have to get the most expensive thing all the time and here's why, I'm practical, you know. And so the two would just fight all the time, and we had these little subplots going on with them. And anyway, so it was really fun to do. But that's so most of the comments are pretty benign, but every so often you do get some comment that gives you a bit of an insight into the dark side of the internet, if you will.
Yeah, I mean that whole comments thing is, it's really interesting to me as a storyteller, because as I mentioned to you, when I finished J school at Stanford, I got out and I really wasn't sold on our career in journalism. And I think one of the things that actually was a challenge for me was I was also doing a lot of teaching on the side. I was teaching some storytelling classes, some applied improv classes. And what I loved about teaching is that real-time feedback in person where you can just see on someone's face how your message is resonating with them. And yet what I felt when I was putting out articles on our school's digital publication, which was called the Peninsula Press, you know, I just throw things out onto the internet, and or posted on my Facebook and stuff, and I really didn't know how the message that I was putting out there was resonating with people, and that kind of frustrated me and kind of made me feel lonely and made me feel like I just couldn't gauge the impact of my work. And as someone who is producing documentary films now, a lot of which are being put out on websites and stuff like that, I'm still kind of grappling with how I feel about that experience. I don't know how you feel.
Right. Yeah, you were saying that because you've been working with Nat Geo. When Nat Geo publishes one of your videos, they have such a huge YouTube following that I'm sure you get immediate feedback from whoever is watching that,
that
both
is really
positive and negative. I mean, what's that been like for you?
It's been really nice to know that a lot of people are watching it. I do get some a little bit self-conscious. Like one of my first videos I did with Nat Geo, a lot of people were commenting that like the music was too loud. And then I'm like, oh shit, is the music too loud? Like, should I go back and edit? Like, oh no, you know? But I still found it was fulfilling. But then like, After I had my first video come out with National Geographic, the video that I've probably made that's my favorite I've ever made, called The Carpenter, I put that out with the Atlantic, which has a much smaller following on YouTube. So whereas my video with National Geographic has like 400,000 views, this one in the Atlantic has like 15,000. And I try not to get too caught up in the numbers though, and just, yeah, but I'm still kind of like figuring out how I feel about that. Like, I don't know.
It's really interesting to think that a lot of our work is effectively being workshopped after publication now. I mean, if you think about before these platforms existed and people were making videos or making films or even writing a script, right? You'd go to like a reading or you'd go to a small screening and you'd workshop it that way. You'd look for some type of reaction or you'd ask people afterwards what they thought or how it made them feel or what they didn't like. And now it's like all of that is happening live on the internet once something's published.
Yeah. Yeah. So when you were doing the producing the web series at the Wall Street Journal in tech, is that how you kind of found this love of yours, like the tech side of things?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'd always been into consumer gadgetry on some level. My brother and I used to make, you know, homemade movies a lot when we were kids using camcorders, and we would like use, oh God, I'm dating myself. Like, we'd have like two VCRs set up next to each other to like physically edit the tapes.
I love it.
You know, and then like I was like always on our first family computer and tooling around in chat rooms and like playing around with AOL Instant Messenger, like all that stuff. And then like even in college, I was like one of the first people in my dorm to get a CD burner, because like I'm pretty sure the statute of limitations is up on this, but we were all using Napster and wanted to make CDs, you know. So, and then I took like a Final Cut Pro editing class when Final Cut Pro first was, I think it was like a couple years after it came out. So it'd always been interested in technology from just a user perspective. And then when I was producing the tech show at the Wall Street Journal, I'd always wanted to be a writer. I'd always wanted to try full-time writing and put video to the side a little bit. And that's where that opportunity kind of came up. I started getting sent around to tech events and conferences and asked to cover them, not just from a video perspective, but to actually write stories while I was there. And I was working with some of the greatest editors in the world. So I just learned a lot from the editors at the Wall Street Journal. And that's how, and then eventually I was offered a full-time writing job. I was offered a full-time writing job, not at the journal itself, but for an offshoot publication that was also owned by Dow Jones, called All Things D. So it was like a sister site to the Wall Street Journal, and it was a lot of really fantastic tech reporting.
What are some ways that, I've never really developed a relationship or had a strong partnership with an editor before. What is so valuable about having an editor who you have that connection with? What did you learn working with some of those great editors that you were with?
First of all, I write long. I've always written long. And so having an editor that has the patience and understanding to know that when they ask you for 800 words and you're going to consistently file like hundreds more than that, and not to like, you know, hopefully they don't want to kill you. You know, that's really valuable for someone to, who's able to just edit down to what you really mean to say or what the most important thing is. Having an editor who pushes you to go a little bit further, like, okay, that's great. You called these six people, call six more, ask about this, or have you explored this angle? That's really helpful. And then I also think just having an editor who trusts you, because especially in consumer technology, I mean, now consumer technology has so many implications because all of the consumer tech products we use are connected and they're connected to these services and platforms that people are starting to rightfully question. But like, even in the earliest days of consumer technology, it's like you're looking at user interfaces, you look at how something works, you look at whether the company has secure data policies, you know, all this stuff. And if you have like a gut feeling about something, something's not working properly, or you have people telling you that something is not working properly, you need to have an editor that trusts you, that when you come to them and you're like, I really think there's something here and I really think I should dig into it more, that they say like, go forth. Mm-hmm. Like, you just want an editor that's like, yes, I trust your instincts, go forth. And I think having someone or alternately talks you down off something, that's a really bad idea. So I think having that kind of relationship with an editor can be really powerful.
Neat. What do you mean by people are questioning their technology more today?
Well, I mean, I like to say that the era of the dumb product is over. Like, we, you know, all products are smart now. They're all connected. They all have motherboards and Bluetooth and Wi-Fi, and that's the thing. I mean, you can look around a more sort of established society, like you can look around someone's home, mm-hmm. and you can see, by established, I mean like developed, you know, you look around and you see like, okay, like my coffee maker is connected now, right? Yeah. Or Amazon is trying to sell me on a connected microwave that has Alexa in it. You know, and so all of these basic things, even the TV, like I just upgraded my TV recently and the one I had before was several years old and it did connect to the internet, but it just didn't offer the same level. This one has like Google Assistant built in and it's running an operating system that was repurposed from something else years ago. And it's kind of practically like a laser pointer. I'm pretty sure it's got eye tracking. No, it doesn't have eye tracking, but like, it's really, this is like a very smart TV.
Yeah.
And you think about all of these things that are now connected, and because they're connected, they're connecting to services and platforms like Facebook and Google and Apple's platforms. Like, and then you realize that nothing you're doing anymore is just as simple as I'm watching a movie or I'm cooking a recipe. Mm. It's all being fed back into some type of data system somewhere, some data collection system.
Yeah.
And so I think people are starting to wonder, and rightfully, what are the intentions of the companies, especially the ad-driven companies that have infiltrated our lives? And if we don't get this under control now, what does the future look like?
And so how does that change what you do? Has this changed the stories that you write, the stories that you produce to answer some of those questions?
Well, it's a really good question. And I honestly, it's something that I'm really struggling with because, you know, it's one thing to provide a utility and to say, here's this new laptop. Here's the trend with laptops, right? Laptops are all getting, LTE capabilities. That's going to be a big push, I think, we're going to see in 2019. And what does that mean? It means they're always connected. You can take your laptop with you on the go. It has the same connectivity as your smartphone. You don't ever have to worry about not having being connected to the internet. Like, and that in some levels is a basic utility for people. Mm-hmm. But then you can also say, like, should any of us be looking at product and design and UIs without looking at the bigger implications? Should I be looking at a piece of hardware that Facebook just put out and not think about the fact and not dig into the fact that it was put out by Facebook, which is currently under a lot of scrutiny for the company's practices? So I think the latter is actually the way in which it's our responsibility as technology reporters to look at this. we can't just blindly look at a product anymore and say, here's this product. And it's like, you know, it's a unibody machined aluminum thing.
Yeah.
Like you have to actually look at what's inside the box and what that box is connecting to.
Wow. Yeah. I guess I never really thought about that. I mean, whereas, you know, some reporters, they'll write a story and probably a lot of people will read it and kind of go about their day. I think a lot of what you write, people are about to go buy that thing. You know, they're about to let that device into their lives, which we know will completely influence how they live.
Yeah, absolutely.
Do you, and so you feel that, what I guess, what sounds like is you're keenly aware of that responsibility. And
it feels that way. And it also feels like, honestly, sometimes I get a sense of dread with a product because I realize that as a journalist, there's maybe only so much that I can do in terms of examining a product or writing about a product or a service. And then eventually you sort of have to wait for a security expert, or let's call them a white hat, assuming their intentions are good, you know, hack into something. And then you're like, well, we all knew this was coming. I mean, this was right. It's like the Alexa stuff. Like, I think Alexa is actually really well designed. I mean, what Amazon's done with Alexa is actually quite impressive. In a relatively short period of time, they've made a voice assistant that works well and is very responsive and has like basically infiltrated, you know, I don't want to say every piece of hardware because that's being hyperbolic, but like a lot of the hardware that people are buying these days. And, but at the same time, like there was a story earlier this year where someone realized that Alexa was like triggered at some point and had recorded a snippet of a conversation and sent it to someone's voicemail. So like, that's just like one of those inevitabilities where you're like, this is happening. This is what's going to happen when we have cameras and microphones in our homes. And so at some point we're recommending these products and we're saying like, here's this basic utility it provides. And yes, it worked as promised. And yeah, it's a good product, but there's always just feels like there's always going to be this caveat now in this kind of reporting.
So you have to, in your reporting, you have to say there, you have to make those, do you have to make those caveats, or do you feel like it's just unspoken? Like you don't have to really call it out.
I feel like there's like an implicit warning that comes with it. Like, for example, if you talk about a product that has, if you talk about the fact that a company is putting out a product that doesn't have a camera in it, Google just put out a smart home product and they specifically left out the camera. It's like the next obvious question is, why did you leave out the camera? And the next obvious question after that is, are you, were there concerns from, you know, your, either within your organization or your early test base or market research that people didn't want a Google product with a camera in their homes, right? And so it's kind of this inevitable thread that comes up now.
When reporting on technology, what challenges do you face as a reporter that maybe are unique to your beat that other reporters on other beats might not run into?
I was just thinking one of the lamest answers I have for this is...
Say it.
Battery tests? I do so many battery tests.
What does a battery test look like?
I mean, it's just like, it's like you have a product that claims 15 hours of battery life and you're like, I'm staying up for 15 hours while I run this thing down. And you know, or like taking, there's a lot of note taking, there's a lot of screenshotting, there's just a lot of like, I'm living with this thing for weeks at a time, hopefully weeks at a time. A lot of times our process is actually much shorter than that.
Okay. And,
you know, there's like things that I deal with. Like I just had to do a couple weeks of travel. I was in New York and then I was in Europe and I was traveling around. And like in the meantime, two companies were like shipping out products, that we were writing about. And so it's like, I had one sent to one address and then I had to go to FedEx and ship back my other stuff because I couldn't all fit it all in my suitcase. Then I had to get something else shipped to a different address. And then, you know, so there's like just a lot of logistics stuff that comes with our particular brand of like reporting on product and product experience that just, sometimes it just like butts right up into your real life.
Right.
Whereas like when I'm doing reporting that doesn't involve product, which I do, you know, I'm just like reporting on something that's going on with a tech company. It's usually just like making a lot of phone calls and meeting with people. So it's a more like human to human interaction as opposed to a human computer interaction.
Yeah. I have some friends who work at a, work at like Apple or Google, and I feel like they're super secretive, even just like talking to me about like, what are you doing at work? They just won't even say.
Yeah.
Do you run into a lot of secrecy challenges?
Yes, absolutely. People in Silicon Valley, it's a very insular community here. It's an industry town, and people have been sort of scared by their employers around what they can say and what they can't say. And in fact, there was just a report in the New York Times either earlier this week or last week, after all of the latest Facebook information came out about how the company wasn't necessarily taking full responsibility for interference around the election. There was like a follow-up report by the New York Times that said like Mark Zuckerberg had essentially threatened leakers. And that's like a very common thing that you hear here. And so I think on the one level, you know, people who maybe understand like workers' rights and understand when things are going wrong within a company and feel like a responsibility to let people know that, or feel like they understand the value of like a free press, essentially, you know, you do like run into people who like will gladly talk and say like, hey, here's what's going on, or here's some insight into what my experience is like working for this company. Mm-hmm. You encounter just as many people who don't want to talk at all. They're working on very secretive projects, and they actually feel like, you know, they don't want the world to know about it because they don't want another company to know about it, essentially. Mm. And so, yeah, the secrecy is like, it's like a very real, it's a very real thing here. Like we have a joke that like there are probably lots of windowless rooms at tech companies around here where there are like products that we haven't even dreamed about yet that are being worked on. And those windowless rooms probably have like black curtains over the walls just in case there are windows, you know. It's like, yeah, it's pretty secretive.
So do you have like sources within the major tech companies who are your go-to sources?
Yeah, I mean, we all have sources. Yeah, I'd say. Yeah. That's probably as far as I'd go.
Okay. Cool. So from Stanford, getting back to your trajectory from Stanford, you went to The Verge after, or were you already there?
I went to Recode. So I had been at Recode before. Yeah. Recode is a small but very influential tech news site. And I had been there before Stanford. I worked there through Stanford. I was still writing columns for them. And then I continued on my career at Recode after that. But shortly afterwards, trying to think of the timeline here, mm-hmm. within about a year, Recode was acquired by Vox Media. That's a VOX Vox based in Washington, D.C. and owns properties like Vox.com and Eater and The Verge and Curbed. And I was moved over to The Verge basically as part of that acquisition deal. And it was actually a really good move, mm-hmm. because The Verge's audience is really, really big. They had a very impressive video team who I got to work with for a few years. And given my background in video, it just seemed like a natural fit. And I was also just covering a lot of consumer tech issues, and that's what The Verge covers best. Whereas Recode was more of a business reporting outlet. So, I ended up at The Verge through acquisition, basically.
Gotcha. Okay. And at Wired these days, are you doing all writing? Are you still involved doing video and audio as well?
I'm mostly writing. Mm-hmm. I'm doing videos once in a while, and I have I'm co-host on a podcast, mm-hmm. that preceded me. It's been at Wired for a while. It's called the Gadget Lab Podcast, and I joined the team as a co-host.
All right.
So I'm doing a little bit of everything now, which seems to be the new. That's what you have to do now.
Gotcha.
To be a journalist. Yeah, I got to do everything.
You got
to
do everything.
You know this.
And so how are you thinking about the different mediums in which you're telling stories about tech? How are you developing stories differently for each of those? Are you going after different audiences with videos versus podcasts versus the articles? Are you covering different content? How do these platforms mediums differ?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a good question. I think overall everyone is thinking about this in this way now in media. I think the core Wired audience is probably someone who's incredibly loyal to the magazine and has been reading it for a long time. We did just go behind a paywall last February, which was a couple months before I joined, actually. So I wasn't there at the time. But mm-hmm. now Wired, you get, I think, you 4 free articles a month, and then you have to pay online. So so it's a very loyal audience that you'll see on Wired.com. And so the reporting is pretty much what you, it's very smart. It's very in-depth. It's very how and why of things that are happening. You know, if you go to the website. And I think, like, but if you went to our Instagram account, you know, you'd see things that are highly visual and maybe targeted towards a slightly younger audience. I think if you go to our YouTube page, you will see that because the YouTube page is part of Condé Nast Entertainment, that it's a little bit more celebrity driven because mm-hmm. we have found that really resonates with a YouTube audience. So yeah, if you go to each of our different platforms, you see the way in which we're still trying to tell the best story we possibly can and make it a very Wired story, but it's done through a certain kind of lens, and it's actually designed for that platform. And I think that's one of the biggest things that's happening in storytelling right now, is like that example I used earlier of just like how we, you know, at the Wall Street Journal video, our initial approach was just to take like the cable news model and then like try to do it on the web, you know, didn't really work. And just as the same as like taking, you know, little clips that ran on TV, like a TV news segment, chopping it up and throwing it on the web doesn't really work either, unless it happens to be like a hugely newsworthy or highly topical thing. Mm-hmm. You have to sort of design for each platform that you're creating for. I mean, I think about this a lot with VR. And you and I obviously like had the opportunity to go to school right next to like one of the best human computer interaction labs in the world, where Jeremy Balanson is doing really cool things with VR. Mm-hmm. But like one of the first VR experiences I had at home, where I actually had like took a headset home with me, was the Samsung Galaxy Gear VR headset. And that's not to say anything bad about Samsung. Samsung did a great job in the early days of making something that was like mobile and inexpensive. But I came home and put it on, and one of the first things I did was go to the Netflix app in VR. And I was like, what's this about? Thinking like this is going to be Netflix content that is actually produced in 360. And instead, I was just like put in this living room, this VR living room. I'll never forget this. It was like an Aspen ski lodge or something like that, you know, super unlike my own living room. And so I'm in this, like, there's snow falling outside and there's like big pine trees and the whole thing. And I'm in this like gorgeous lodge, and all it is in front of me is a flat 2D television screen, like the one I have at home. Right. And there's like a Netflix special on it. And I'm like, this is the Netflix in VR experience. Mm. You know, granted, this was, like I said, this was early days, maybe just 3 to 5 years ago. But like that was not Netflix in VR. That was here. We're going to give you a slightly more immersive experience. You're going to be in a fake living room, but then you're still watching 2D flat content. And I think the best VR experiences I've had is where I've put on the headset. I've actually been in a completely immersive world that was designed for that. And the story was designed for like, okay, look up now. Okay, now look down and you're going to experience another element of the story. Okay, look to the right and you're going to experience this element of the story. And that's the way it was actually designed. And that triggers the most emotion.
Mm, I love that. So what platforms are you thinking about? How do I design stories for these days? Like, what's on your mind?
I'm still thinking a lot about video, honestly. I'm still just thinking about how to reach people on our YouTube page, even on Twitter video and things like that. We found that we have really good engagement on Periscope, surprisingly, a little bit more so than Facebook Live these days. Mm-hmm. And so still very much thinking about 2D, if you want to call it like flat content, as opposed to three. I haven't like really produced anything in 360. But yeah, like just thinking about, especially now with YouTube pushing people towards longer videos. In fact, I hate to like sound like I'm a shameless plug for Wired, but
hey,
my colleague Paris Martineau did this really, really great story on Wired the other day about YouTube pushing, or no, excuse me, it was Emma Gray Ellis, not Paris. Paris did another great story on influencers. Emma Gray Ellis from Wired did a great story about YouTube pushing people towards longer content, and how all these influencers who used to make like 2.5 minute videos are now making videos 20 minutes or longer. I'm really curious like what that holds, because like the thing about like making videos for platforms like Amazon Video and Netflix and stuff is that it's a really great opportunity for some video producers, I'm sure, to work with those companies and to have that brand name. But the model is basically like you're getting paid up front. the content is being commissioned up front, and then there's like no more back end. That whole idea of the back end that was, you know, in Hollywood for so long is like kind of going away with those platforms. And I think like there are other platforms out there that still allow a brand to have control over their videos and over their storytelling, but still tell really good long form stories. And so that's something that's really interesting to me.
Do you have a video that you've produced that you felt like worked? And if so, why do you think it worked?
Well, and like one of the most popular videos I've done at Wired so far was actually just around an iPhone launch, which I think says a lot more about what people are interested in on the internet than it does about any sort of like high end production on our end. Mm. I was like, here's a new iPhone, you know, and it does really well.
Yeah.
When I was at The Verge, you'd mentioned Versus earlier. Versus is one of those things that completely surprised me. I didn't think people would be as into it as they were, and then they were. I think it was because we were providing a little bit of fun, but we were also providing a viewer service of like which tech to consider. Mm-hmm. And then I worked on a series called Next Level at The Verge that I really liked because it was future looking. We went behind the scenes and talked to some of the area's top tech companies and went to labs and talked to people, not necessarily about something that was shipping tomorrow, but like what is the technology that's going to impact people in the next 5 to 7 years. And that ranged from Dolby Labs using biometrics to gauge how people are reacting while they're watching content, to Airbus working on a really cool concept plane, to I ended up working on a video with a fantastic team of people that we ended up winning an Emmy for that was about exoskeletons, the use of exoskeletons both in the medical field to help. I mean, literally, we saw a paralyzed man like walk with the help of an exoskeleton. And how exoskeletons are also used in the industrial workspace too, like how a Ford, factory worker who works in the assembly line who has to do the same repetitive motion 800 times a day could be helped by use of wearing an exoskeleton.
Wow!
So things like that, like I personally really enjoyed reporting out, but I think that they resonated with audiences in a way that's a little bit different from like, look at this shiny new thing.
Interesting. What about, I noticed like in the Versus video series or, you had the podcast Too Embarrassed to Ask. It seems like you use humor a good amount in your storytelling.
Yeah, I do, I guess. Or I try to. Maybe people don't think it's funny. It's totally fine if nobody thinks it's funny.
I think it is funny and it's fun. And I guess my assumption, I'll give you my assumption and then you can agree or refute, whatever, is that a lot of people come to tech news because they want to have fun. And it does give you a different sense than watching or reading the national news, which can often be a big downer. And I wonder if using humor in the videos, in the podcasts, in all forms, is a way that tech reporting kind of differentiates itself, or the type of reporting you do that kind of opens the door for people and says, like, come on in, let's have some fun, like, let's hang out. I don't know.
I'll say this. I think some of it's very unintentional. Mm-hmm. I think like some of it is just so, sometimes when something is really absurdist, you don't realize it's such until you call it out for being absurdist. Mm-hmm. And then you're like, oh, right. It is really weird that Facebook's doing this.
Yeah.
How ironic, you know? So I think like sometimes you kind of arrive at that, like the, how maybe silly or ridiculous some of these things can be. I can tell you that when we were planning Versus, sometimes we went in like knowing we were going to be very tongue in cheek about something, but not knowing if people would find it funny. So that's something that you always like sort of face when you're trying to strike the balance between doing someone a solid by doing good reporting, but also trying to be somewhat entertaining. But I also think, like, I learned this from one of my mentors and former editors, Kara Swisher, who's an incredibly well-known tech reporter and rightfully so, who I worked with on the Too Embarrassed. She was my co-host on the Too Embarrassed to Ask podcast for a long time. She has this very irreverent approach. where she just says what she's thinking and she kind of calls people on their bullshit for lack of a better term. And she, you know, I think that's her way of letting people in the tech industry know, like, look, you may take yourself very seriously and that's all well and fine, but I'm not necessarily going to take you so seriously. I'm going to call this what it is.
Yeah.
And she's very funny as a result of that. Like, she's actually very, people find her incredibly entertaining and incredibly engaging. And I think that's something that worked really well on the podcast we did together, where she was often very irreverent and I would tend to be a little more earnest, and she would tell me to, like, not be so serious about it, like, you know, and it's something
nice
I really
balance.
Yeah, it's something I think I learned from her.
How are you using social media these days?
Too much. Rethinking my Facebook strategy.
Oh, what does that mean?
Well, you know, when I was at The Verge, Vox Media set a few of us up with, like, professional Facebook pages as journalists, and I, like, barely maintain this. So that's the thing about all these, like, social media presences. It actually takes work, and then you're like, I'm supposed to be doing real work at this point. So I might rethink my Facebook strategy, and then my personal Facebook page is also, like, a little bit dormant these days. Mm. Twitter, I'm still very much on.
Do you have a Twitter strategy? Obviously, you have a very large following on Twitter.
It's usually one of the first things I check when I wake up in the morning, and I check it for the news. Mm-hmm. I'm just all about, I want to see what the news is. I want to see what people are talking about. I use it as, like, my own personal RSS feed, although it's getting a little bit unwieldy. And then I usually try to tweet something that we've been working on as soon as I can, like, first thing in the morning, because I just feel like that's part of that early morning news audience. Mm-hmm. And then I end up tweeting, like, probably, I haven't counted in a while, but maybe 5 times a day or so on average, I'd say. I usually try to make it a good mix of stories and observations, not always wired stories, but often wired stories. And I just find that it's a really good way to engage with people. Even today we published a video, and I'm finding that some people are responding to my video on Twitter rather than responding on YouTube. Hmm. So I see it as a way to find it, like, engage with a different kind of audience and maybe get people to, you know, realize that we at Wired are real people and that we are receptive to them. Mm-hmm. And so that's, like, yeah, I spend a lot of time, I'd say, hanging out on Twitter. And then I'm on Instagram too. And I do love Instagram for just how visual it is. And I love just learning about how the way, like, people express themselves on Instagram. But I do feel that it is one of those platforms that's a little bit, like, unreal in terms of people presenting themselves a certain way or presenting their lives a certain way that is probably, like, the most, like, glossified version of their lives. Mm. So you just sort of take that with a grain of salt, I think.
Yeah. Well, talking about, you know, designing stories for their platforms, I've been thinking a lot in this past year about doing that through social media platforms, because probably a year and a half ago, I was somebody who was like, I'm going to delete all my social media. Like, I hate this. Like, it's producing clutter in my life. I don't like it. And then I really started to see the potential for helping me make a living in the future as a documentary filmmaker and photographer, someone who does this for a living, and as a way to tell stories, as a way to share stories. Mm-hmm. And so then I started going, like, all in on it. And I've been thinking a lot just about that. And for me, my kind of strategy, if you will, on Instagram is, I kind of have my main Instagram feed is almost like a photography portfolio. Mm-hmm. And it's usually photos of other people, and it shares their story. Sometimes it's their quotes. Other times it's more of, like, a reporterly voice of mine writing about the circumstance. And then the Instagram stories feature is more documenting my personal journey, trying to make a living doing this. And my kind of theory behind that is, using kind of those Instagram stories, I can get people to invest in and care in me as a person, which will make them more likely to watch whatever videos I'm creating right now as a freelancer, because the topics vary a lot. But I also kind of just repost the same photo on Facebook and Twitter. And I know that I need to think more about how to design for those specific platforms, because the way that people show up there, the audience on those platforms, where they engage with content, is very different for those different platforms.
Yeah. And it's not just about, that's a great point, because it's not just about the way the audience is engaged, but it's also about the algorithms, whatever, and those are so opaque, right? Whatever Facebook decides it's going to start promoting in newsfeed on one day, it could be totally different from how Twitter is operating, which also, by the way, even though Facebook owns Instagram, could be different from the algorithm they're using for Instagram that day. Mm-hmm. So it's a constant battle, especially for somebody like you, where you're trying to maintain these two presences of here's my professional work, but here's who I am as a filmmaker. Mm-hmm. Understanding, like, it just feels like understanding what is actually going to resonate or reach people is kind of a crapshoot. So, like, I hate to use this word, but it feels like all you could do is just be authentic. Publish what you want to publish, and publish like what you feel you want people to see behind the scenes, and then be like, well, maybe this will reach somebody. Maybe it'll reach somebody who hasn't heard about my documentary about maternal health in Zambia before, and then they will be attuned to what I am doing. And that's like kind of all you can wish for.
Totally. Like, I'm applying right now to this New York Times 52 places traveler job, the person who like gets to travel around the world for the New York Times for a year.
Nice.
And in the application, they ask, like in the second round of the application, they ask you to make a 60 second Instagram story giving a guided tour of some place. And I know that the odds of getting it are very low, but I still, like, I put that Instagram story out to my whole, you know, follower base and told them, like, I'm applying for this job. Mm-hmm. You know, those are the moments where I'm like, you know, it feels a little bit vulnerable because there's a good chance I might not get it, but I want to document my process.
You end up going for that?
I went to Stanford. Mm-hmm. And I gave a 60-second tour of the three places that shaped me at Stanford. So I went to the classroom where I first took my first creative writing class as a freshman, which kind of put me on the path to journalism. Mm-hmm. I went to the soccer field because I played for the Stanford soccer team. And then I went to the theater where I performed as a Stanford improviser. Improv theater. And had like a little mini takeaway about how that shaped me. Mm-hmm. And tried to jam it into 60 seconds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's one of those things too where I'm sure they're not just looking for they don't expect you to be in an exotic locale, but they want to see they want to see the lens through which you are seeing things. Mm-hmm. They want to see your storytelling capabilities, because if you can go back to that improv spot and make somebody feel like they're there and say the interesting thing about it, then presumably you would do that in the 52 places around the world, right? Like, you mm-hmm. would think that's part of the process. But I hear what you're saying, because not long ago, you probably would have applied for that job and like you would have, you know, put something out into the internet and it would have fallen into a black hole. And you'd be like, I'm not going to tell anybody I'm applying for this.
Yeah.
And also, I have no idea where it went. Mm-hmm. And now it's like, it's all out. You're just supposed to put it all out there.
So on your...
I find your use of the word vulnerable really interesting.
Mm. You say more about that.
Well, I just think part of being vulnerable is admitting that you're vulnerable. And most people on social media don't really want to do that. Mm. It's like, it's an armored version of themselves.
On your social media, do you share your own personal opinions or share like things that are personal about you? Or is it mostly about the stories you're writing, tech thoughts? I don't know.
On my Instagram feed, I tend to share more personal photos.
Okay.
You know, visiting with my mom, or occasionally pictures of groups of friends and things like that. Sometimes I have a tendency to try to document a lot of women on my Instagram feed. I often will ask somebody who I think is inspiring if I can take a picture of them and then put that up. Mm-hmm. I tend to lean more in towards the group of like, I am not as interesting as other people or the stories I'm trying to tell. Mm-hmm. And even though I do take like a lot of selfies, like I like selfies because I'm like, I was here. Like I just took a selfie. I was just at this, I haven't posted it yet, but I was at, went to Portugal for a work trip. And then I ended up going to Nazaré, which is the location of this giant, giant wave when it's breaking. And I went there, it's about 2 hours north of where I was, to try to see the wave. And I was like, I have to take like a selfie, right? Like I'm here. And I like that as a timestamp of like, I'm here. But, mm-hmm. but I do tend to think that like what other people are doing is much more interesting. And there's also the part of me that thinks like from a business perspective, it's actually better just to drive people to the story. Mm-hmm. If I spend a lot of time working on a story and then I blurt it all out in my Facebook feed, you know, why, like, go see the edited and really thoughtful version on wired.com, right? Is my thought process.
Right, well,
here's a glimpse or here's a teaser. Here's mm-hmm. what I've been working on. But
yeah, because otherwise they have no incentive to get behind the paywall.
Yeah. And then your thoughtful, well-reported story ends up like amid, you know, I don't know, like a fake news article that someone else shared below that, or, you know, one of those like cooking videos that shot overhead sped up times 10, mm-hmm. which is like all over Facebook.
Yeah.
I'm like, really? How did you make that cinnamon roll in 2 minutes? I'm sorry. That didn't happen that way, you know, or whatever it is. Like those are all over my Facebook feed, especially this time of year. So yeah. So like, why not give someone a more curated experience if they're going to read a news story?
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, we're almost out of time here. So I think I got two more questions for you.
Okay, I'll try to make my answer short because I ramble.
No, you're doing great. Okay. For me right now in my career, as I shared with you earlier before we started the podcast, was I really want to work with a documentary director who has a lot of experience. I'm like seeking out opportunities where I know I'm going to, you know, not going to be the one creating the story at the highest level. I might be getting some coffee for people. And I feel like I want to go do that because I think the learning I can get from other people at this stage of my career, my early career, is going to be so valuable. And I'm wondering if you could reflect on the beginning of your career. What are some lessons that are allowing you to be successful today that you learned back then?
Oh, that's a really good question. I would say, I mean, my experience as a production assistant was really, really impacted me. And, you know, it, to your point of like getting coffee, there was a lot of that. I remember one particularly funny request was like one of the sportscasters at some point wanted to say, this was a morning show, by the way, so we were all in very early, wanted to say something like a team was going to be raw meat that weekend. You know, they would fight over who was going to win what game and whatnot. And he was like, I need raw meat. You know, so I was like running around Manhattan looking for a deli that was open, you know, early in the morning to get some sliced raw meat or whatever. You know, like I remember things like that. I remember at one point, actually, this is not funny at all. One of the hosts was having chest pains and was like, could you run across the street to Dwayne Reed, you know, quickly and get me some Tums? And I was like, sure. So I like ran across the street and ran back. And by the time I got back, there was an ambulance and he had a heart attack. And fortunately he was A-okay, but you know, it was not just minor chest pain. You know, that was just, it just always felt like it was a lot of running around, and that was fine because it was a great experience and I got to be in a newsroom and all of that. But, I mean, I think one of the things that you should learn as you're starting out your career is like, you need to work hard and you need to do a lot of jobs that you probably don't initially want to do, but people should always treat you like a human being. People should always treat you with respect. And even if you're low on the totem pole, even if you are working what is a low paying job, you should still be treated with respect and you should still have like human rights and you should still be able to like take a break and go to the bathroom, you know, like all of those things. And so if you find yourself in a situation where that is not the case, you should have a voice and that you should be able to have a voice in that situation, or you should be able to have opportunity beyond that. And so that's like a very real thing I learned. You know, you're trying to find a way to create opportunity beyond that. And then another thing that I learned early on was like, was know when to leave. I probably have just had the experience of staying in a couple of jobs like a year too long, you know, knowing that at some point it was probably time to leave and that I had outgrown the experience and not doing it for some weird loyalty reason, or maybe even just like, I need to pay the rent. Right. So, which is a very real thing. So yeah, I would say like, those are two things, like knowing when to move on, but also knowing that like your rights as a human being, as you go into a job where you are still working up and you are still learning up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Great reminders. Thank you. All right. So before I ask my last question, where can people go to see your work, to find you?
I would go to wired.com, look for Lauren Good, look for the Gear team, actually, or Gear team or business team. Actually, look for all the teams. The culture team does great work. Transportation team. It's really great reporting on wired.com. I am also on Twitter. I'm at Lauren Good with an E at the end on Twitter.
All right. So my last question for you would be, if anyone out there is interested in getting into tech reporting, or they already are doing it, what advice would you give them? I'll just leave it at that.
Just keep doing it. I would say, if you want to get into journalism, it's a really tough business, and the business models of journalism that surround journalism right now don't make it easy, of course, to stay in journalism. But I would say that if you believe in good storytelling and that's what you want to do, you just have to stay with it. I would also say, don't be afraid of hierarchical systems or feeling like you can't write just because you're not within a certain structure. Like, it took me a really long time to become a full-time writer because I spent so many years in the video world where people were effectively in some way telling me that I didn't like know how to write, or my writing wasn't good enough, or I didn't have the structure. Now, granted, my writing was probably not very good. But that said, like, just keep doing it. And now there are so many ways to self-publish, and there's so many ways to create your own audience, that, you know, be committed to telling good storytelling, do the work, but also know that, you don't have to listen to people who have been working within like a certain structure for so long telling you, you can't do it. Just know that you can do it. That's probably very nebulous and not very clear.
I think that's great advice.
I fully believe that. And some of my best mentors have, like, first of all, just had really good faith in me and good faith in my writing, and like helped guide me towards that. But like, one of the biggest things they've done is just help to instill confidence. And it makes me wonder like why I was so afraid to vocalize early on. Like, I just want to be a writer.
Totally. For me, like, when I was looking for some opportunities as a video journalist or in documentary film, I was working a tech job in Palo Alto. And I was like, man, no one's hiring me. And then I was like, you know, screw it. Like, I can just start a YouTube channel and just start making things. And of course, there were a lot of people watching those videos, but there's something about the momentum that's created when you just start making things.
Right.
You know? And
it's so true.
And it will build your confidence. So I think that's great advice.
It's so true. And any self-aware person, any self-aware creator is going to have the ability to look back at some point and say like, I made a mistake there, or I could have told the story that way, or I'd probably do this differently in the future. But that's all part of the process. And to not do something because you're afraid of that process is just the wrong reason. You have to go through it. You can't go around it. You can't suddenly arrive at like this point in time where you're like, I've done 10 films, or I've like written for 7 high profile publications and written these really impactful stories. Like, you don't just arrive there. You have to go through it, and you're going to make mistakes along the way, but just make them.
Amen. That's a great note to end on.
Yes. Thank you so much for chatting with me and letting me chat.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thanks, Austin, for asking me to do this.
All right. That's it for episode 7 of the Austin Meyer podcast. This was definitely a conversation that had me feeling very energized afterwards. I think it's just inspiring to talk to someone who is so ambitious with the variety of ways in which she tells stories, and also inspiring to talk to someone who really thinks deeply about the moral implications of the work we do as journalists, because the stories we tell really do shape the world. So thanks again to Lauren Good, and friends of the podcast, listeners, please go check her out on social media. Again, that's at Lauren Good on Twitter, Good spelled with an E at the end. Thanks to the Sunrunners and Opus Orange for today's theme music. And of course, thank you to you, listener, for tuning in. Also, in personal news, by the time this podcast is out, I will just have arrived in New York, where I will be until December 20th. I will be there with the hopes of making connections in the documentary filmmaking industry. So if you know anyone I should meet, please reach out to me, austinmeyerfilms@gmail.com. I'd love to know, love to make some connections out there. And if you want to follow what I'm up to, follow me at austinmeyerfilms on Instagram and Facebook, or at amyerfilms on Twitter. I will see you next week back here on the podcast, where I will be chatting with a National Geographic photographer about telling stories through images. So until then, I hope you have an amazing week. I'll see you soon.